Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The human trafficking hotline ranks Ohio the fourth worst state for human trafficking, which includes the consumers of prostitution. In Franklin County, most Johns are fined an average of $72 for solicitation, which is about half the price of a speeding ticket. And they're sent to John schools where they listen to guest lecturers talk about the cost of human trafficking, and they watch slideshows about sexually transmitted diseases and more. Now, Columbus police officials and some state lawmakers are looking to change the demand side of the sex trafficking equation with tougher fines and different charges that should lead to jail time. Jennifer Knight is acting deputy chief of the Columbus Division of Police. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You supervise the Policing Community Together, or PACT unit, and that's the one that replaced the disbanded VICE unit. What's the current approach to dealing with the demand for prostitution? What's been the traditional approach, I should say?
So the traditional approach by law enforcement is this is an offense. It's a misdemeanor offense, and our job would be to go out and enforce that and look at it from a law enforcement perspective, which is pretty much one-dimensional in a lot of cases. And we've looked at over the years expanding that, saying how do we break the cycle of prostitution? How do we have a greater impact on this issue, which really does impact our neighborhoods? And so when the VICE was disbanded by Chief Quinlan, and he came to me and he said, we need to do something different. Do some research, look and see what's out there, and let's approach the problem differently. And so we spent a lot of time looking at how to build a better model for the Division of Police, because it's very frustrating for officers to go out and make an arrest, and then these individuals get a very low fine, they're released immediately. They're literally back on the street in those neighborhoods before the officer finishes their paperwork. So it's frustrating for law enforcement. It's very frustrating for people that live in those neighborhoods that are impacted by that. And it feels like we're not making a difference. So we had to look more comprehensively at the problem and develop a comprehensive approach.
Where did you look?
So we looked all over the United States at what other cities were doing. And we saw that there was a lot of good work being done locally by our nonprofits. But nationally, Minneapolis is doing some innovative things through work with a nonprofit called Men Breaking Free in addressing demand reduction. And Seattle Against Slavery in Seattle is a demand reduction and victim service initiative as well. The U.S. Institute Against Human Trafficking addresses demand and provides victim services and works in a few cities like Austin, Texas. So we were seeing nationally that we needed to stop just looking at the very visible side of this, which is prostitutes that may be walking the street or maybe in hotels, and look at demand reduction. So those are some of the things that we looked at, and we realized that we have been approaching this problem by looking at the supply, and we need to look at the demand, or we're never going to solve this.
You've called for tougher fines and jail time for Johns, but it's not that simple. You're talking about a change about how we view both sides of this equation.
Absolutely. We've actually put together a more comprehensive approach for the Division of Police and what we think will have a much greater impact in the city of Columbus. I kind of need to frame this problem a little bit for individuals who don't see this. Residents and children in neighborhoods in Columbus, they readily identify prostitutes in their neighborhood.
They know who they are.
They do. And it's very interesting. I have actually spoken to middle school and high school students. Students are interested in this topic, but a prostitute, the average age to enter prostitution is between 12 and 14. So we really have to start looking at those younger ages. And I went to Mifflin Middle School, and it was a room full of girls, and I was just basically talking to them about this issue and some red flags. And I asked for a show of hands. How many girls in this room have seen what they believe is a prostitute walking their streets? And almost every girl raised her hand. So this is an issue that impacts our neighborhoods. It's very much tied into alcohol and drug addiction, and they're intertwined. They coexist. It attracts non-residential solicitors to inner city neighborhoods, and the locations of where prostitution are supporting not just prostitution, but they become epicenters of crime for drugs and guns and other things. So framing that issue is very, very important. It's not just the visible prostitution, which is a misdemeanor offense. What this is much bigger. It creates epicenters of crime. It impacts, it results in a lot of other crimes in the neighborhood. And we have to start looking at this problem as much bigger than just someone walking the street.
The Dispatch did famously, pretty recently, the series on Sullivan Avenue, and identified that as the primary epicenter that you describe and everything that it attracts. For years, we would hear stories about how the approach just moved the problem to the next block.
Yes.
That's kind of changed.
So we are looking at this problem by saying we need to break the cycle. When we talked about just taking somebody to jail, they rarely spend more, you know, any time in jail at all. A $72 fine. I think the women that we arrest actually spend more time in jail. But when they do bond out, their traffickers are bonding them out. So we have to make sure that we're not pushing the problem to another street. When we look at it, we said we need to develop pillars of what we're going to work on. We need to, and we've developed five pillars. One of them is criminal justice, a criminal justice pillar. And that requires legislative support, enhance the effectiveness of what we're doing, work with our city partners, the city attorney's office to draft legislation. And Zach Klein has been very much on board with drafting legislation to say, we need minimum standards for what we're giving offenders when they come in, increasing these penalties. So if you offend one time or you offend 50 times, the penalties are the same. There's no minimum penalty there. And so we have to look at, is this the first time this person has purchased sex in the area?
Or they've been caught doing it.
Right. And so we catch a very small number. It's much greater, but increasing penalties and making people understand that there are significant penalties to committing this offense is going to allow us to these offenders absolutely can hide this when they're arrested. They can hide this behavior from their spouses, from their families, from their employers.
Because the consequences are so
little. They're so low. They never spend a night in jail. And so we have an arrest policy, whether it's the supply side or the demand side, buyers or sellers, everyone goes to jail. And the reason why is very different. We take the buyers to jail because this is literally the only consequence with such low fines right now. We take the sellers, the prostitutes, to jail because it creates a window of opportunity to separate them from their traffickers. And we need that opportunity to push them towards services, to push them towards programs like Catch Court that have been able to make real changes for these women, and addiction services and all of these opportunities to break that cycle. And so a lot of people are like, oh, they're victims. Why are you taking them to jail? We are literally doing that to take them out of the hands of their traffickers, to give them an opportunity to detox, to provide them a way out. And that is the only way we can do that right now.
Just so listeners, CATCH stands for Changing Actions to Change Habits. And it's a specialty docket for women who are in the system, who have been arrested and are victims of human trafficking. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Acting Deputy Chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Jennifer Knight. And we're talking about changing the conversation about managing the crime of human trafficking from both the supply side and the demand side. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to hear from the coordinator of Franklin County's Catch Court, and we're also going to hear from a teacher at the John School in Columbus. And tell me a little bit about the John School. It doesn't sound like penalty. It sounds like a mosquito.
Okay, if John School is the only thing that these offenders get, it's not enough. We have to look at the offender population as there's underlying issues there as well. So when we're crafting legislation, we have to look at John School as an opportunity for first-time offenders, maybe, but not second and third-time offenders. So our goal is to get in there and get those offenders to someplace like John School, because we need them to recognize the impact on the community. And some of our John Schools have a real opportunity to enlighten a first-time offender. But it's about 6 hours. It is some really good programming, but it's not enough. We have to mandate things like substantive fines. We have to make sure that we have an opportunity for them to serve time in jail if they're offenders that have offended multiple times. Jail time is a real deterrent for this offender population.
We look at prostitutes as doing something bad to themselves. Do we look at Johns as doing something bad to themselves?
Well, we need to in a certain way.
It's like the provider, the supply side, is sort of demonized as doing something stupid to themselves. Mm-hmm. But the Johns are just taking advantage of that. And I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like a very safe or self-respectful thing to do.
It's absolutely not, but it's driving the supply side. And I don't think we've looked at it that way. We've just said, you know, we've looked at the very visible part of this, which is the prostitute on the street, and we fail to see those cars driving around picking these individuals up. These Johns, in some cases, are violent. These women are subjected to rape on a regular basis. They're subjected to all kinds of violence. These individuals are not necessarily coming into the neighborhood and just committing a minor offense. And we need to look at these Johns as part, a substantive part of the problem. So our programming has to make sure that we're not letting them off with a $72 fine and just John School.
I want to take this call real quick because it's a question that always comes up when we have conversations about this. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just see this as the exact same failed argument for the war on drugs. And if we really want to eliminate the trafficking, which, you know, the human trafficking, that's the really the heinous part of this, is that we just legalize it. But you still, even when something's legal, you still are going to get illegal activity.
You'll have the black market, right?
Right, right. And so there's no way getting around that. But when you legalize it, you tax it, you track it, all kind of things that you can do, the same with drugs. And then law enforcement can focus on helping the community a little bit more, or, you know, and okay. Law enforcement's like the hardest job ever.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
it's the same failed argument. And these people are addicted to sex, too. So they have an issue also.
Mm.
So maybe we can use that tax money to help the users and the people being trafficked. But it is the traffic that's the biggest problem. And I got that. I at least appreciate she's trying to do the right thing, but I don't think creating another revenue stream and sticking it to the users is the right thing, because the war on drugs failed.
Okay.
You have to admit that.
Okay, well, let's just see what Deputy Chief Knight says about that. I mean, it's obviously not a new concept. Legalize it.
Yeah, I've heard that many times. The annual size of the U.S. commercial sex market is estimated at $5.7 billion. And I have to say that making sex transactional creates a victim class, and it removes a legal barrier and tells the next generation that these individual sexual acts are basically commodities. This is not a profession. Young girls do not dream of growing up and becoming a prostitute. These women are addicted, they're abused, they're assaulted on a regular basis. So, you know, studies have shown that it does not reduce the violence women experience by making this legal. It just normalizes the behavior. And you can't normalize prostitution, because the act of paying for sex is really just not normal. It's an expression of inequality between women and men, poor and rich, black and white. And it's a form of slavery. Between 90 and 92% of the women that we come in contact with are being trafficked by another individual. this does not empower women. It's when you see these women walking on Sullivan Avenue, they're addicted, they're exposed, they're homeless, they're abused. Do they appear empowered? They're not. They're marginalized, and their stories are absolutely tragic.
Tell me about the traffickers, the pimps, mm-hmm. and what sort of strategies are out there for them. You've already said that when you arrest a prostitute, it gives you a window of opportunity.
Correct.
Before the trafficker swoops back in, pays the bail, and they're out. But what about them?
So the real goal is for us to make sure that we identify the traffickers, the ones that are trafficking women. These are the felony type offenses. And the Human Trafficking Task Force in Ohio is a very robust task force that works to identify and build cases and put these individuals behind bars. We debrief every one of the women that we arrest, and we do that so that we can identify who these traffickers are. These women are being trafficked by boyfriends, husbands, individuals that have aligned themselves with these women, that provide them the things that they need to feed their addictions. They keep them in line with violence and with drugs and things like that. So our real goal is to make sure that we can not just get that cycle of prostitution into that cycle and break it and get these survivors out. But it's also to make sure that we identify those traffickers and put them in jail.
When I mentioned that I was doing this show, someone over the last couple of days said, oh, is it because of the Arnold? And it's well known. I mean, you can go to the back page and, online, the website, and you can see how the ads increased, from the weeks,
yes.
the days heading into big festivals like that or anything. The Michigan State game. Sorry, everybody. The Ohio State Michigan game, that kind of a thing where you're going to have lots of people coming to town. What about that challenge?
So large scale sporting events draw this kind of activity into an area. We have to have a comprehensive plan for when we have these types of events. We already have something in place. The Human Trafficking Task Force and our PAC team are working very closely to identify and make arrests for individuals that are committing this type of behavior. So we want to let everybody know we are out there. If you're going to be selling or buying sex in Columbus during that weekend, be careful, because we're out there and we are looking to make arrests.
My guest is Jennifer Knight. She's acting deputy chief of the Columbus Division of Police. She's calling for tougher penalties for the demand side of the human trafficking equation, that is prostitution in particular. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Columbus Police, the courts, and some members of the Ohio General Assembly have proposed tactics to shut down the demand side of the prostitution equation. They're calling for stiffer fines and tougher charges and other things. Still with us is Acting Deputy Chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Jennifer Knight. Hannah Estabrook is a licensed clinical counselor and coordinator of Franklin County's Catch Court. CATCH stands for Changing Actions to Change Habits. It's a specialty docket for women in the system who are victims of human trafficking. It's Estabrook.
You got it.
Okay. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Christopher Stoller is an anti-trafficking advocate who also teaches at the Johns School in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you.
Listeners, I certainly want to hear what you have to say about this. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chris, you've spent 2 years teaching men who have been arrested for solicitation at the Johns School in Columbus. When I've read about it, it sounds sort of I don't know, like they're just clawing their way through 6 hours of something that they don't really care about in the first place. I mean, that's just what it feels like when I've read about it. What's it like?
Right. So that's a great point. I've been teaching there now for over 2 years. I have taught over a couple hundred men. And this program, there's about 50 of these in the country. They vary. Some are, like here in Columbus, are only 1 hour or 1 day, 6 hours. Some, like in Seattle, are a 10-week comprehensive intensive program.
Now that sounds like
right.
punishment.
Yes, yes. You can't hide from your spouse. You can't hide from anybody with that kind of a model. So I definitely think it's a very good solution to this issue, to actually be able to, our one chance to sit down with these men and help them understand the connection between prostitution and trafficking. But it needs to be much more robust. We need something that's much more comprehensive.
What have you learned about the problem from teaching at the school?
So the biggest thing that I've learned, we actually worked with the city attorney's office to look at the last 10 years worth of data that they have on these men. About 850 men have gone through the program since 05, and we've looked at their responses in surveys that they filled out. And hundreds of these men, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes and misconceptions about these men, that they're all sex addicts, they're all porn addicts. There are those cases, but what we found is that these men are dealing with really complex issues, everything from depression and loneliness to mental illness and addictions. So those aren't excuses, mm-hmm. but they help us understand that a solution for one man might look very different than for another guy who's struggling with deeper issues of mental illness.
And Hannah Estabrook, I was wondering, from where you sit in Catch Court and coordinating that program for the women who are arrested, mm-hmm. and what do they think about the Johns? What are their thoughts?
Yeah, it's great. So it's true that the majority of my knowledge around Johns or buyers of sex have come from the stories I've heard from the women. And so to be completely honest, I've heard all kinds of stories. I've heard the stories of violence, and it's clear that there are some men out there who are perpetrating some pretty significant harm against some of these women. And then I've also heard stories of Johns who were quite kind and, you know, Johns that, we're sort of just good customers, for lack of a better
regulars,
description.
That
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Thing.
So certainly those stories have informed much of my perspective.
And when I look at the numbers that I've seen in the newspapers, at least, they come, and I think you mentioned it as well, Deputy Chief Knight, that they're coming not from the neighborhoods they're going to. They come from outside of the neighborhoods they're going to, at least when it comes to the street crime.
So it's very interesting. Our offender population, our Johns, are driving through these neighborhoods. A lot of times, there may be a few of them that actually live in the neighborhood, but what we're seeing a lot of times is they're driving from other neighborhoods into these locations, and they're picking up these girls in those locations. The one thing that we've noticed about this offender population is it's a little different than some of our other offender populations in Columbus, because a lot of them have their own private attorneys, which is unusual. And so, again, a $72 fine and 6 hours of John school isn't going to have the same impact as a few nights in jail or $300 fine or something like, a more robust John school, which we've looked at the Seattle program. We think that's an excellent program to build something out to something like that.
It's a goal.
It is a goal. It absolutely is. So it's very interesting that the busiest time in the city of Columbus for prostitution is between the hours of 6 and 8 a.m. We make a lot of arrests during those hours. That seems to be the time where a lot of these women are out on the street in the early morning. And that's because people are driving into downtown Columbus. They're driving to work in the morning. And we were really surprised to find that out, but that seems to be one of the busiest times for us.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about strategies to decrease the demand for sexual prostitution. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Jennifer Knight. She's acting deputy chief of the Columbus Division of Police. And also with us, Hannah Estabrook. She's coordinator of the Catch Court. And Chris Stoller teaches at the John School. How does the John School in Columbus or Franklin County work now?
Sure. So currently it's a 6-hour program. The men who are arrested, it's mostly men, they go through a 1-day training and they bring in individuals like myself from a nonprofit that help educate them on the bigger issues. Then we also have licensed counselors there who talk to them about issues of depression and mental illness and loneliness. And then we also have survivors that come and speak and talk to them about what it's like to be, you know, on the streets and having gone through the Catch Court program.
What do you think is the most effective? Or I guess it depends on the person?
It ultimately depends on the person. You know, I've been there for more than 2 years now. And some guys, you have to kind of put yourself in their situations. For some of these men, you know, they're not listening. We're not going to be able to reach them, right? I mean, they're just there. Some of them falling asleep in their desks. But for other men, you can tell the ones that are really paying attention, the ones that the victim's stories, the survivor's stories are really impacting them. In the last 2 years that I've taught more than 200 men, we've had 3 of those who have since become anti-trafficking advocates with our organization. So they are now teaching with me at the John School, where they're coming and sharing their story about, you know, they're telling these guys, hey, I sat here a couple years ago and here's what I've been able to do since then. So we've had some success stories.
What kind of questions do they ask?
Most of them aren't talking. Most of them don't ask. We always ask them. We challenge them at the beginning. Share your story. Think through deeply. This is your one chance to reflect on what led you to this point. You know, what's going on in your life, in your relationships, in your lack of relationships that led you to this point. And so there's always a few brave souls at the end that will share their stories to, you know, I've heard everything from a 70-year-old man who had just celebrated his 50th wedding anniversary that chose to solicit, down to, you know, a 19-year-old that got caught. So it's a really big range as to why these men are here.
You know, when I read a fleeting reference to them, as most of them are first-time offenders, which to me is a misnomer, isn't it, in a way? They're just first-time caught.
First-time getting caught, right.
Yeah. It's not enough offenders we have a difficult time catching. We're out there working that on a regular basis, but we think we are able to actually make an arrest on a very small portion. But we do know that if it has an impact, if John School and some of these other programs have impacts, these men tell other men. And so it has a ripple effect. There is a benefit to making sure that we're changing behavior. They tell other men. There's been a lot of studies to determine whether or not what percent of the population actually offends. And it's somewhere between 6% and 15% of men actually buy sex at some point in their life. But a small percentage actually get arrested. And so we have to have better operations for the police department to make sure that we're making as many arrests as possible. But we also have to follow that up with real penalties and programming that is tailored to whatever their individual needs are. So we have to empower judges, give them a lot of opportunity to identify individuals that need additional counseling, individuals where John School is just not going to have an impact, where jail time is absolutely the one thing that will impact that individual from, you know, reoffending.
Hannah Esterbrook, we're getting more calls about legalizing prostitution.
Sure.
And we already took one call on it. And I'm just wondering what your understanding is about how people who have been there and done that think about legalizing it.
Yeah, that's great. So I think DC Knight did a great job of answering that question a little bit earlier. But I think even, you know, when we look at Sweden or the Nordic model, the approach of decriminalizing sellers of sex and sort of going after more the buyers.
Okay.
So even in those instances, you know, studies I've seen sort of suggest that those women are still really suffering. And the reality is that sex work is very hard work. And there's still just an incredible amount of trauma around, you know, the stories of the women who get into that work and then while they're in it. So whether it's legal or not, that's still the reality. And so I get it. I get the cries for legalization because I think it comes from a place of, you know, honoring people's autonomy, wanting to see people get resources if and when they're ready. And so I can completely understand the argument. But I'll just say for me, speaking more to like the traumatology of it, you know, when you have that much trauma in a woman's story before she enters something like sex work, it's hard for me to advocate for legalization. at least at this point, when we don't have robust resources available to these individuals, except through the criminal justice system, at least for now.
Let's see, Charlotte in Linden, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. I'm quivering with rage. Excuse me if I'm not quite, or even more incoherent than usual. I know of a case of a child that was pimped by its own mother. Mm-hmm. So I support these measures, but I want a whole lot more. That child is now in protective custody, and yet the parent that trafficked the child was permitted to visit that child in protective custody just past 2 weeks. I would appreciate it very much if DC Knight would give me a call. And if you've got my number to give to DC Knight, fine. And if you haven't, I'll take DC Knight's number over the air because she and I have something to talk about.
Well, I'm sure that, I mean,
Deputy. The child is currently on 9 psychiatric medications.
Yeah.
Well, pimped by an own parent.
Yeah, it's devastating.
So this is not something that we haven't come across in arresting these individuals.
You know what she's talking about.
Absolutely. So juveniles are trafficked at a very high rate, and we see them on a regular basis. We absolutely are looking to make sure that we get them out of that environment in any way, shape, or form that we can. In the past week, we've come across juveniles that are being trafficked by parents. It is absolutely unacceptable and tragic to see those circumstances. And a lot of times there is a drug addiction attached to that. We are doing everything that we can to do that. That is a felony. It's not a misdemeanor crime. They cannot, a parent cannot do that. So we're looking at working very closely with the Human Trafficking Task Force because that's a case where they get involved and they look to prosecute and build cases. It is very hard for people, and you can see hear the passion in her voice.
Yeah.
It's very hard for people to see that type of activity and find out that that was occurring and a parent was the person that was doing the trafficking.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of people working on those types of things that are occurring at the Human Trafficking Task Force as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Charlotte, thanks. Mm-hmm. I know you're upset, but thanks for calling. Mm-hmm. You know, Christopher Stoller, I'm just thinking about those kind, you know, what Charlotte said. I suppose you could put her in front of one of your John's classes and she'd give him a piece of her mind. But
right.
I think the issue of child prostitution, mm-hmm. I mean, when we're talking about young children, we're starting to learn so much more about it because of the internet now.
Sure.
And the internet busts that are out there. Do you talk about that and the contribution of any kind of demand for this contributes to the demand for that?
Yes, absolutely. And I completely share her rage. I mean, every time I teach at the John School, it's very emotional because on the one hand, I'm furious. But on the other hand, you know, this is our one shot at helping these men not repeat the same offense. And one thing I should have clarified at the beginning is that, you know, this program is not for men like that. The men that come to the John School are not involved with child prostitutes, child victims. It's for men, first time offense.
What do you do with them if you find that they are though?
I would defer to Deputy Knight on that. I don't know the main legal difference in terms of that, but John School is primarily for men. It's first time offense. They're typically caught in reverse sting operations where they may not be an actual woman who was involved with being trafficked. It's an undercover officer posing
yeah.
as a
the
as
hotel
a victim.
Room
correct,
kind of a thing.
Correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Gotcha.
So, but yeah, I share her rage and John School is not ideal for someone like that. We have to focus for those kind of men. I mean, you've got to focus on increased penalties and increased measures because the John School is not going to stop them.
Yeah.
And I would say that typically the judges are not going to be just handing out John School to those
right.
individuals. John School is for first-time offenders, is for individuals that have picked up someone over the age of 18.
Consensually,
it isn't for someone that's trafficking victims. That is not a response to someone who is trafficking other individuals at all. Trafficking is a felony in Ohio, so we're talking John School is dealing with a more of a misdemeanor offense. So it really wouldn't work for this offender population that's actually trafficking. When we identify victims that we believe are being trafficked and we debrief them, we try to do that when we believe they're being trafficked by another individual, our goal is to get that victim out of that environment and to basically get them hooked up with services and break that cycle. And it is to go after those traffickers. Absolutely go after those traffickers. And the internet has changed the game. I mean, 20 some years ago when I came on the division of police, human trafficking was something you saw on the street. Now with the internet, so much of it occurs there. And we want to make sure that we're not taking what's occurring on the street and pushing it underground so that it's occurring on the internet. But the division of police and the human trafficking task force, we work both sides of that on a regular basis.
If I could just add, this is just semantics, but child prostitution isn't a thing.
I know.
It's child sex trafficking. These kids can't consent to this kind of thing happening. So when we're talking about a man who's soliciting a child, we're not talking about the crime of soliciting or prostitution. We're talking about a different crime altogether. So I think that's to where Chris was saying John School wouldn't be offered to that person.
Right.
That's a much more serious crime.
We are talking about changing the equation of human trafficking when it comes to the sex trades. You just heard Hannah Estabrook. She's coordinator of the Catch Court. We also have Christopher Stoller. He teaches at the John School. And Jennifer Knight, she's acting deputy chief of the Columbus Division of Police. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about efforts in Columbus and at the state level in Ohio to curb prostitution with stronger penalties for johns and traffickers. Still with us, Acting Deputy Chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Jennifer Knight, licensed clinical counselor and coordinator of Franklin County's Catch Court, Hannah Estabrook, and anti-trafficking advocate and teacher with the John School program in Franklin County, Christopher Stoller. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have pretty much dealt with the issue of legalization. For those of you out there, who want to bring that up, it's kind of something we've been talking about. We've already talked about, and if you can go back and listen to the podcast or the archives later if you missed that part of the show. I want to turn right now. Well, first of all, I do want to mention something we were talking about off air, and that's semantics and the words we use to describe all of this. And sometimes I feel stupid using the word johns. Mm. It sounds like we're infantilizing or we're kind of like somehow diminishing what it is that the people who pay for sex are doing. Mm. And I wondered if you could talk about that, Hannah Estabrook. It just sounds like the johns and the prostitutes. It's just like a hugely different sort of lexicon.
Well, that's true, but I may not be the best person to ask, and here's why. I don't know that the kind of equality I want is a more derogatory term for men who buy sex. I understand sort of the cry for equality and the cry for justice, and gosh, if these women who have been called awful names, and even the word prostitute is not a fun word, but when you think of John, it seems so casual, so,
Yeah, it's a name, at least.
It's just a name, yeah. And so
But it's more humanizing than the other side.
But you know what? They're humans. And so I am actually not a person who says we should call them something else. To be fair, I am a champion for restorative justice, both for these women and for these men. Mm-hmm. And I think that while we're looking at increasing penalties and all that kind of stuff for these men, which I understand, I also think, and this is maybe the clinician in me, But what I'd really like to see is someone to champion a restorative justice movement where these men are getting cared for in the criminal justice system and in terms of addressing what is it that's driving the buying of sex, you know, and really asking the question, just like we've learned to ask with regard to these women, what has gone on in this woman's life to bring her to a place where she's selling sex on the street? I want us to turn that same curiosity toward these men and say, what is it in this man's life that has caused him to get to a place where he's buying sex on the street? And let's address that. And so, yeah, in terms of semantics, I'm not going to be the champion for a harsher term.
Well, I mean, harsher, I don't know, but I think
that's a great question.
It's a good answer. I wanted to turn to Danielle now in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Danielle. You can describe your situation yourself. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me call in. My name's Danielle, and I'm a former prostitute. I've been off the streets and off of drugs for over 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And when I was out there, there were no circumstances for the men. And what we have now, the 6 hours of John School, like they said, they can't hide from their wives. With that bigger program. Where it's like 10 weeks intensive.
Uh-huh.
It's just, when I was out there on the streets, I was fighting for my life. Mm-hmm. And these men are there just to take advantage of that. Mm. On both sides, the traffickers and the Johns. Mm-hmm. And I just, I agree with you that we need stricter consequences for the men that are out there paying for sex.
Well, Danielle, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your perspective, obviously, and best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right.
Oops, sorry about that. There's been legislation put forth in both the Ohio House and Senate. I think the House has got some traction, but they're complementary bills that would stiffen penalties for Johns and create what I think the most important part of this is the public sexual exploitation database of convicted or admitted Johns and traffickers. And I'll just go right to you, Hannah Esterbrook, and what you think about that, because that's the public humiliation piece of
this. That's right. So first of all, I will say this. My understanding is that it wouldn't be for first-time offenders, but that if a first-time offender has gone through John's School, really come to understand, you know, the world of trafficking and sort of some of the consequences associated with this, and they've continued to offend, that then they would go on this database. And so, but personally, I don't know that shame is a great motivator in a sustained way. I mean, I think shame certainly does motivate behavior. And can cause us to shift directions, at least in the short term. I think long term, though, if we're not addressing the greater issues going on in our worlds and in our interior lives, it's actually not going to do much good. So this, I'm not speaking on for the court or any other perspective. It's just my opinion that I'm not into the shame-based approach.
And DC Knight, what do you think?
Well, I get this question quite a lot when I speak to the public and we go out into the community. We talk to them about what's going on in their neighborhoods with prostitution and these types of activities. And I get this question a lot. Can we put their name in the newspaper? Can we put them on a billboard? The shaming it would have a deterrent effect. I really think it would. But I think we have to consider the collateral damage to that. These men... I don't think we're necessarily going to do anything other than drive this underground more, this activity, because we're not dealing with those root causes. There's a lot of collateral damage to putting somebody's name on a billboard or in the newspaper on a database because, granted, they cannot hide it from their family and friends, but these men have children and wives that will become victims and had no knowledge most of the time that their behavior was occurring. So we have to be very careful with that. I think that a database for repeat offenders is something we can consider.
Would that be helpful to law enforcement?
Well, we're going to know that this individual has already offended. We have the mechanism to do that.
Okay.
There is it's hard to gauge whether the public has a stomach for this type of database. I think that it's probably going to be used by employers and family more than anything, because they're going to want to know, is the person that they're And so when you're looking at restorative justice, if this person has gotten out of this behavior and has solved this problem, these underlying problems, then how long will we keep that database? Mm. And how long before we allow them to reenter society? Do we keep them from having jobs? There needs to be a certain degree of transparency with these offenses so that they cannot hide this behavior. But there are a lot of ways to do that. And more robust programs, I think, solve this problem as well. So I do, we were talking, that was Senate Bill 247, I believe.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of good things going on with that Senate bill. You know, they're separating offenses. They're looking at sexual exploitation as an offense.
And using a database for that, too.
Right. So I think that there's a lot of things in that bill that may be very beneficial as we look at this problem more, you know, comprehensively. But we have to be careful that not to create collateral damage for children and family members that had no knowledge that the individual was engaging this behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. A question for all the guests. Maybe they might choose which would want to respond. I'm very much for the restorative justice. In general, the Vice Department, or what it's renamed, where they've engaged in paid informants, undercover activities, it does get useful information. It does get some arrests, but it also tends to discourage honest people from reporting to police because there's a perception of they're involved in bad activities. But the question I've got is, and it was mentioned earlier by one of your guests, one of the ways that these arrests are made is young female officers recently recruited go undercover, pretend to be prostitutes. When they're approached by a John who would say whatever the word is or make whatever physical action, then they're arrested before they physically are able to do anything. A big concern I have is if a young woman wants to become a police officer, they know that this is likely what they're going to be assigned to. And besides the fact that it's probably very traumatizing to these officers to engage in these kind of activities, I think it discourages recruitment horribly. Well, that's a downside of it.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that? And I'll take it off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. I don't think I've gotten that one before. As a female officer and with the Columbus Division of Police. When I was younger, I don't do it anymore, I actually did participate in those reversals. I don't think it discourages individuals from recruiting. It's absolutely voluntary. We're not going to put an officer out there that's not interested in doing this kind of activity.
Some people just might not be good at it.
Yeah, you're not going to be good at it. And so I actually thought it was a huge opportunity to do some undercover work in the early part of my career and basically get a better understanding of how those operations work. So I actually thought it was a great opportunity. Most of the women that participate in this, they're all voluntary, but they see this as a real opportunity to impact this issue. And I think most of the women that come and volunteer to do this type of activity see this as a great opportunity to take buyers off the street. And I think that they see that as a huge part of the problem and they want to do this. So I'm also over the recruiting department right now. And actually, that has not deterred recruiting at all. It's always hard to recruit women for law enforcement. But the women that come here see that as an opportunity.
And Christopher Stoller, we only have about a minute left. But I wanted to ask you if you could, you're at that 6-hour program right now, and the goal is the Seattle 10-week program. If you could change one thing right now about John's school, what would you do?
Making it longer, making it more intense and comprehensive. I mean, several people mentioned you can hide behind that, right? You can make up an excuse for why you're going to be gone for 6 hours on a Saturday right now. But to have something like a 10-week program, you can't hide that from your significant other. That's something that's going to, I believe, can really help deter. And having
to own up to that.
Right, right. And the other, the Seattle model works directly with licensed counselors who are there every single week to help these men. So in some cases, they might be dealing with really deep issues. In other cases, they might not. So having someone like that to help walk through these men can really make a difference.
Christopher Stoller teaches at the Johns School in Franklin County. Also, Hannah Esterbrook, coordinator of Catch Court. Thanks to both of you. I appreciate it. And Acting Deputy Chief of the Columbus Division of Police, Jennifer Knight. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.